KALW.
Water is like a natural resource that we all need to survive, but through marketing and through consumerism, it's kind of been sold to us.
Today, we'll meet an artist who takes ordinary objects and experiences and reimagines them to find new meaning.
So I kind of wanted to play around with like these basic objects that are usually used in like labor when you wash dishes, you hand wash clothes, and like elevate that.
Multimedia artist Robin David. Then we talked to Oakland City Council member Carol Fife, who recently led a campaign to cap the annual increase on rents in rent-controlled buildings.
That greed is what's causing the growing homeless crisis.
And three Bay Area authors read from their books for and about young people. That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. If you do a web search for cabbage, what will you find? That was the question that led artist Robin David down an internet rabbit hole, and it resulted in a cabbage-themed sci-fi short film. In the search, she found cabbage sculptures, cabbage slippers, cabbage hats. And as KLW's Dorothy Tang found out, much of Robin's work follows a similar path, a journey to understand the cultural and personal significance of everyday objects.
The first piece of Robin's work I saw was a cabbage floating in space. It's a short film where a cabbage turns into this morphing blob, moving around as the viewer gets further and further away from Earth. There's no narration, just space sounds swelling around us.
These little clips of videos pop out of the Earth.
Video clips of cabbage. One is from China, a 65-foot cabbage statue.
Then there's a video of this person making fake cabbage, maybe out of wax or plastic, in like an industrial kitchen. And then there's a video of a cabbage competition somewhere in the South.
In this experimental film, Locating Cabbage, Robin gives us the feeling of being small through the use of sci-fi imagery and sound. Robin is trying to make a larger point about how we get our food, how we relate to it, and how we rarely see the work behind it. Robin, who uses the pronouns she and they, grew up in Vallejo. For many years, they didn't have much access to art. This changed in high school when their older cousins started bringing them to community art shows.
I met people of color folks who were artists, musicians, writers, and poets, like Filipino punks who were just like making work that was for them and had like a supportive network community, and they were all like super cool, just doing their own thing. And I think that was super important for like my development as a young person, a young artist, to like feel confident in wanting to make work that represented me and like people that looks like me from my perspective.
Robin brings that desire to represent Asian American experiences to work that's been at SF MoMA this spring. With her art collective called Macrowaves, Robin made a commissioned piece, an interactive mural for an exhibit called Representing Chinatown. SF MoMA's Director of Public Engagement, Tomoko Kanemitsu, walks me through how the mural works.
There's these red circles, and if you touch it, a kind of background sound from one of the films will play. And then there's also, it kind of lights up a certain area of the mural.
Oh, is it when you touch?
Yeah, you can touch it.
Is it, you press this, you press the wire?
You can just touch this.
Robin and Macrowaves sourced these sounds from iconic Asian American films, such as The Fall of I Hotel and Chinatown Rising, which depict Asian Americans mobilizing against the gentrification of Chinatown. The mixture of visuals and sound helped to engage our senses, something that Robin often does in their personal work. Robin doesn't only work with film. When I visit her Emeryville studio, she shows me a sculpture titled Water, a Sensation.
when you think of water, water is like a basic source, a natural resource that we all need to survive. But through marketing and through consumerism, it's kind of been sold to us. So really it's a exploration of our relationship with like natural resources and just kind of flipping the way we see like water and the way we see like fountains usually are like this upscale, like you usually see them in front of like fancy buildings or like government buildings.
But Robin made this fountain out of brightly colored strainers, wash tubs, and other plastic objects.
So I kind of wanted to play around with like these basic objects that are usually used in like labor when you wash dishes, you hand wash clothes, and like elevate that.
Water was originally a free natural resource, but now it's purchased in bottles and displayed in man-made fountains. It's become an object. That's a running theme in Robin's work, our relationship to objects. Robin explores that relationship in their work to make sense of personal experiences with much larger contexts. One of her pieces is inspired by something she saw growing up, a strange coffee mug her father had, and the feeling she had around it. She says her father was a boob guy.
It's this weird story of like male fetishism, but like he liked little Kim growing up. Like he just would talk about it openly. And so he owned this like boob mug that there was a hole in the nipple and like liquid could fall out.
It kind of terrified Robin.
Like growing up as like a teenager, I was like confused about like breasts and like puberty.
This experience became the inspiration for what Robin says is one of their most memorable installations and performances, titled Boobies of Christ. It's a religious ceremony about breasts. The performers wear pink shirts with different colored breasts sewn onto them. They pray in front of an altar made up of a mix of Catholic imagery and candles, fake money used for Asian cultural practices, and breast-shaped plushies. After praying, the performers continue their ritual. They drink liquid from a bowl, hold hands, and shake and grab their bodies.
Creating this performance, like Boobies of Christ ritual, like growing up Filipino and Catholic, I'm really confused about like body and image, but like kind of making fun of the whole experience because it is very weird, very traumatizing, but also really like dysfunctional and like silly in like the way that Catholic rituals are so old-timey and like taken too serious. But when you think about it out of context, it's like really bizarre.
So Robin's taking those rituals and subverting them.
And like playing with it as a way to like process my own trauma, but also like process like colonialism and rituals and like how like, you know, through religion has like influenced the way like my dad talks about women, for example.
Robin is interested in the relationship we have to the way we spend our money, how we practice our religions, and how we feel about our bodies. The interactive and playful aspects of Robin's work allow for the viewer to be lighthearted when thinking through big themes. In Emeryville, I'm Dorothy Tang for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Dorothy. You can see the Representing Chinatown exhibit at SF MoMA through tomorrow, June 30th. Check out KALW.org to learn more about the exhibit and Robin's work. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. In Oakland, the city council approved an ordinance earlier this month that caps rent increases in rent-controlled buildings at 3.6% this year. The move was met with opposition from some landlords and property owners who argue that the cap will hurt them most. KALW's DeAndre Ball and Sunni Khaled recently spoke with the author of that ordinance, Oakland City Council member Carol Fife.
In reviewing some of the press releases about the ordinance that was passed yesterday, I saw that there was a number of Black and brown landlords and other folks who gave public comment who were concerned that the new ordinance would be a barrier for Black and brown landlords who are trying to generate wealth due to it limiting maybe their ability to raise rent as associated with like inflation. What do you have to say to like some of the Black and brown property owners?
I would ask that Black people specifically, because I was born this way, and Black and brown folks really do more than just a cursory investigation for legislation. I think we're oftentimes used by powerful interests, big money interests, to represent positions that don't necessarily benefit us. And I know just yesterday, people were just flat out lied to. This does not preclude people from increasing the rent. And it also provides provisions for individuals to increase the rents above the cap that was passed yesterday on its first read if the 3% isn't sufficient. But that's not what you heard. That's not what landlords were told. And I am the biggest advocate for building Black power than anybody on city council that's ever been on council. And I would not put forward something that would jeopardize people being able to have their needs met, Black people being able to have their needs met. The first fallacy is that this will depress rents and not allow individuals to raise their rents. That's not true. What it's not allowing is this runaway capture of rents that would create more homelessness. And if we are paying attention to Oakland, you know the largest group of unsheltered homeless people are Black people. The greatest number of people dying on Oakland streets are Black men. We had our first ever mortality report that was done, and it showed that Black men are dying above and beyond every other racial group in the city. I want somebody to care about that population as well when we're talking about housing and homelessness in Oakland.
If this measure is not enacted, what happens then? How high of an increase in rents are we looking at? What happens to the residents in the city?
Without this measure, landlords would be able to increase this year renters' rates by 6.7% or 100% of the CPI. And that is just unconscionable in my perspective. And so that would push people who are still trying to recover from COVID and a host of other issues that existed before COVID onto the streets. And so for Black folks, it will have the biggest impact. We are the largest share of renters. We are the smallest percentage of individuals who are homeowners. We are the only racial group in the city of Oakland that's shrinking. There are a myriad of reasons why this policy would hurt Black renters in the city of Oakland. And people are asking for policy exemptions to be made for a smaller class of individuals. And that's just not sound policy. So it would be devastating for Oakland's renters, Black and all included.
I saw on your Twitter this morning that you announced that you'll be authoring a resolution allowing for 13,000 social units in Oakland. Can you share with me like what was the planning process to take the steps to want to author this proposed legislation? Like when did this start to become something you were working on?
It's something that I've known about since 2019. There is what I consider to be an old school segregationist law on the books in the state of California under Article 34 that requires for low rent units to be constructed in any city in California that the voters authorize its approval. So after Roosevelt passed fair housing legislation, there was a reaction from white people around the country. And in California, there was a law that was passed to limit the number of units or limit units, period, that were able to be constructed for low-income people. And that was just a euphemism for Black people at the time. And so in order for Oakland to develop the number of units necessary to address the growing need, a need that has not been met by our current development process, we need to address that law. So that is why I'm bringing forward an initiative to request that the voters authorize the development of these low-income units in the city.
What was the genesis of that? What led you to propose the measure for the cap now?
Because I come from organizing with grassroots groups, people are always reaching out to me when they feel like they are in peril, and I have a hard time saying no in general. So I started receiving several phone calls and emails and tweets in my inbox saying, Councilmember Five, do you know what's happening? Please stop this, what's been referred to as a rent bomb, from passing in the city of Oakland. So I learned about this in May, that this was happening, and I was asked to address some of the fallout that would occur if this rent increase went through.
What about the property owners? Some are saying that this cap may drive them out. They may have to sell. Do you think that one of the reactions could be more gentrification in this city of Oakland? We could see more homelessness even with the cap?
I want to differentiate property owners from landlords. Those are two different classes of people. So I want to be clear. And if, once again, you are a landlord and you can justify that this cap is not sufficient for you to make a fair return, there are existing laws that allow you to increase the rent above the 3% cap. So the sky is not falling for landlords. And there are far more tenants that are at risk of homelessness than landlords at risk of foreclosure. All of the state measures that were passed to support renters during the pandemic are accessible to landlords, as well as the four methods in the city of Oakland that would allow landlords to petition for an increased rent increase. So that claim is not true. It's not based in reality. It is the hyperbolic reaction to a class of people that want to be able to increase rents on rent burdened individuals as much as they desire. And that greed, that type of ethic, is what's causing the growing homeless crisis. That's a part of the reason why housing should not be a commodity in the first place, because it does move people to want to get as much money as humanly possible. And I would argue that that is not human. It is quite frankly, an insensitive response to what I believe is a human right, which is people being able to access shelter. And it is counter to what we should be doing as a society.
That was Oakland City Council member Carol Fife speaking with KALW's Sunni Khalid. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, we're bringing you three readings from Bay Area authors. It's a collection of episodes from KALW's literary podcast, New Arrivals.
This is New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Today, we'll hear three local writers read from their novels. Naomi Krupitsky lives in San Francisco. Her novel, The Family, came out in November of 2021 and became a New York Times bestseller. It's written for adults, but the main characters start out as young girls in the 1920s in an insular Italian-American world.
It's about Sophia and Antonia, two best friends who grow up together in Brooklyn. It's their coming-of-age story, but it's also about the mafia. This paragraph is from the very first chapter, where we're starting to get to know how close Sophia and Antonia are, but also how isolated. Sophia and Antonia close their eyes and make the world. Together, they go on safari, narrowly escaping bloody death in the teeth of a lion. They travel in airplanes to Sicilia, where their families are from, and to Japan and to Panama. They survive in the wilderness with only two sticks and a tin of Christmas cookies to sustain them. They escape quicksand and locusts. They marry princes who ride down bedraggled Red Hook avenues on horseback. Sophia and Antonia straddle their own horses. They lean forward and whisper into their horses' ears. They shout, "Fly like the wind," and are hushed by their mamas. "Go play somewhere else," the mamas say. Sophia and Antonia play on the moon.
That was Naomi Krupitsky reading from The Family. Krupitsky's coming-of-age story was written for adults, but our next book is for younger readers. It's also about isolation and belonging, and it has some supernatural phenomena thrown in. It's a graphic novel called Squad, illustrated by Lisa Searle and written by Oakland's Maggie Takuda Hall. It came out in October of 2021.
It's a story about Becca, a new girl at Piedmont High who's never belonged before and is thrilled to find that she belongs for the first time to the most popular group of girls in school. There's just one catch. They're werewolves. Here's the deal. We were all given a choice. We could be normal, or we could be powerful. Ourselves, but better. The thing is, there's a cost. Every month, at the full moon, we have to eat. If we don't, the hunger takes over. A deer won't cut it. Rats don't do shit for us. It has to be human. I'm gonna be sick. Oh, please, we can't help that we're hungry. But we can control who we eat, where we eat them, what we leave behind. One of us isn't enough to polish off a body. Three of us almost is. But four, there'd be nothing left. No evidence. Obviously, we can't eat people from Piedmont or the gig'd be up like snap. How could you use me like that? What if he'd... Stop. We were watching you the whole time. We'd never let him hurt you. We don't let boys hurt us. We hurt boys. Only boys. The worst ones. People call idiots like him all kinds of names. Creeps. Jerks. But the right word is predator. And that's who we hunt.
That was Maggie Takuda Hall reading from Squad. Our last book is also for young readers, with a protagonist who must save his grandmother from a relocation camp. Berkeley author Shanti Sakran's The Samosa Rebellion came out in September of 2021.
The Samosa Rebellion is about a 12-year-old named Mookie who gets his neighborhood together to form a grassroots rebellion against some pretty daunting forces in his country. It's also about butterflies and grandmothers and, of course, samosas. I'm going to read a passage from the start of the book that sort of sets us up in Mookie's world. He and his parents have just picked his grandmother up from the airport. He calls her Pati, which is a Tamil word for grandma. In ocean view, every house is two stories tall and made of brick. Each one's crammed right up against the next, and the streets are so narrow that people string laundry lines from house to house. Our clothes hang over the street like parade flags. Drive down Mingus Avenue, and you might see my dad's underwear flapping in the wind. Pati stares past me, out the window at the old brick buildings, the one crooked stop sign, the storefronts with the awnings and painted windows. She sees it all with new eyes, like a little kid, and like a little kid, she twists this way and that, trying to get a better look. "Butterflies," she gasps. From the rear window trails a welcome parade of orange butterflies. This is Pati's world now. Whether she wants it or not, this is Mariposa. I wonder what she thinks of it. I wonder what happens next.
That was Shanti Sakran reading from The Samosa Rebellion.
New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse, and you can find more at klw.org/newarrivals.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Hanisha Herjani, Lucen Mendel, Raphael Cohen, James Rowlands, Gabe Graben, Victor Tense, Shireen Adil, Shaya Levitt, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.